This is a Collider.com audio interview.
So I assume this would be a tough book. Oh,
the cameras? I just have to get these. Thank you.
I assume this would be a tough book to adapt, because whenever you deal with time travel, it's always hard to be able to visualize it and try to get it in some kind of way that an audience can watch it and figure things out. I mean, how much did you work out with Robert as far as how much of the book to include, how much stuff you have to add to make it easier?
I'll tell you a long story as fast as I can. I found this movie in an ad in Variety. Not an ad, but a little article that New Line wanted to do, make a movie of something called The Time Traveler's Wife, and I really got very excited by the concept, and I managed to get a copy of the manuscript, and I read it, and I said, I have to write this movie. And I fought like mad. And Bob Shea and I were working on a movie together called Mimsy at that point at New Line, 4 years into it, an eight-year process. And I actually begged to do this movie. I met with all the producers. We seemed to have a really strong understanding. I started working on it. I started imagining how this was all going to work, and it was really exciting to me. And then another writer came in who was also doing a very big movie at New Line, and somehow or another, he got the job. And it was totally, totally devastating for me, because this thing was in me and it was alive. And approximately 4 years later, I'm in Costa Rica at Christmas, and I get a call from my agent saying that there's a new director on this project and he wants me to write the script. And I mean, I never had an experience like that in my life. And I thought, oh, this is extraordinary. And so I came to L.A., met with Robert. We were on the same page with this movie. We both saw it as a love story. We both knew the movie that we wanted to make. And I sat down, and 4 weeks later, I had a script. And that script was absolutely, if you will, delivered. I don't know how many of you write. Every so often, something is delivered. It's the most extraordinary and wonderful thing that happens in writing. And it's not happened to me often. Jacob's Ladder, it happened to me. But mostly for me, I just sat and just knew scene to scene to scene what this movie should be. And what I knew was that it was a love story, and that it followed the dictates of a love story, that it has an arc, that a love story, all love stories have a particular arc. And even though this played in time, it didn't matter where I went in time, as long as this love story was moving forward. That's all that mattered, and that's what I tried to do. And it told me how to write the story. It literally told me. And so I don't take a lot of credit for it, except that I was lucky that I could listen and have had years of training in terms of listening to stories and how they need to be told.
As an audience member, for the first 20, 30 minutes of the film, I'm trying, because I know it's time travel, I'm trying to keep track of where he's going and why and when. And after a while, I just sort of let that go and thought, well, there's more to this than that. Uh-huh. How valid is that as a response to this film?
Very valid. We fought a lot, not fought, it's the wrong word, but we were very concerned about how we get out the rules of time travel, how we layer them into the movie. It was very important that the movie not be a movie that just makes you cognitively involved and not emotionally involved. I think the moment you probably got sucked into the movie, and I think it was an important moment, is when he sees his mother on the subway. And you suddenly go, oh my God, this is about something other than the manifestation of time travel. It's the emotional life of someone who can do that. And when that happens, the movie starts to speak differently. And as the movie goes on, at least for me, that element of the movie, the fact that it allows you a richness of emotional experience that normal linear life doesn't, the movie starts to gain weight, gain emotional weight.
One of the biggest differences I found between reading the book and seeing the movie is in the book, you're just kind of living in this world. Like, you kind of follow Henry on a bunch of different trips, right. But the movie has to have a much more linear path. So kind of how did you decide how to craft a path out of that and still give the audience the feeling of the book without having so much time to be inside it?
Well, I knew I couldn't stop the movie every 2 minutes and say Henry is now 14 and now Henry's 28. And I mean, there was an earlier version of the script by the person who replaced me that tried that, and I read it and it didn't work, and I was very glad he figured that out and I didn't. I benefited. It does, because you can't watch a movie from your head. I mean, I don't know how many of you watch yourself watching a movie, but you watch a movie from your gut, here and your heart. These are the two places that you experience movies from. And if it's a great movie, you can also kind of tap into your head as well and have it be almost a full-bodied experience. But you don't want to watch it primarily from your head unless you're watching Memento or something like that, where you can't help but do that. And that's its own kind of experience, and it's puzzling and it's fun and you're doing all of this kind of stuff. But a real movie tends to be centered lower. And so I had to find a way to make this movie come from here and not make it something you're thinking about all the time. And when you're thinking about it, what happens to me when I read a script and I have to think about it, or a movie, it takes me out of the movie for about 20 seconds or 10 seconds, whatever it is, and it takes about that long to get back into the film. And by that point, you've lost time in the movie. And building your trust in the movie again is hard. So I didn't want that to happen. It's unavoidable on some level with this movie. The first 20 minutes or so, especially for men, and this is not a men's movie, particularly this is a real two-quadrant movie. You know, it's a really female movie, and I expect you guys are all going to beat us up in the press because unless there's an emotional life, most guys are not going to love this movie. My younger son watched it, and he said, you got two quadrants, Dad. He said, I'm not in it. And I understood that. I really understood it. It's a very emotional and emotionally driven film. Does that answer your question?
Can you take us through a few of the different physical manifestations of Henry's time travel that you all experimented with before settling on the one that was actually in the movie, and how much input did you have?
The life of a writer in Hollywood, I won't go into the whole drama of that. I was never on the set. I have no idea what went on with any of that. We could take you all aside later and talk about what it means to be a Hollywood writer. I had the privilege of getting to adapt this movie, and turning it into a script that I think was worthy. It got made into a movie that I still think is worthy, although it's different in some ways than the script. It has integrity, which for me is the most important thing in a movie, because movies are not the book. Movies are not even the screenplay. They are the movie. When I wrote my first film and directed it, and I looked at it for the first time on what's called an assembly. You look at this movie, which is every scene you wrote, every line you wrote of dialogue, and you want to kill yourself. The minute you see it, it's like, how did I write something so horrible? And I remember the director of photography turning to me afterward, because I was almost on the floor, and he said, Bruce, now you make your movie, which is true. Your movie starts to come alive when you realize all you can make it with, all you can build it with, is the images on the screen and the performances on the screen. So as a screenwriter, I have to turn my work over to a director and let them build it, in the same way that an author like Audrey has to risk everything to give this to a studio and say, make the movie you want to make. It's hard. It's hard.
Can you John? Talk a bit about Rachel and Eric's, sort of how they plugged into what you wrote?
I can't tell you what their process was. I can only tell you that there is an energy coming off of them on the screen, and I don't know what it is about Rachel. You can see it in The Notebook. You see it in almost everything she's in, and most men I know see it. It is unbelievably attractive. It just sucks you in. It is so alive and so seductive. And she does that. She just does it on the screen. That's her performance. And I fall in love with her. And I think anybody on the screen, any male on the screen, is in love with her. And I think the two of them have wonderful chemistry. And I think that they're wonderful embodiments of this, of who I envisioned would be on the screen. I mean, I started writing this movie when the movie was going to be, I thought, Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston. So that's how far back this goes. And I was writing it in my mind originally for them. So I've had to go through lots of permutations of who's going to be in the movie. But I kept hearing Rachel's name for a long time because we share lawyers. And they kept saying, she wants to do this, she wants to do this. And I thought, that would be great. And then she did it, and I think it's wonderful.
What kind of feedback, if any, have you received from the novelist? Has she seen the movie? Did she read the script or give you any input or suggestions?
I honestly don't think she's seen it. Okay. I'm not sure she wants to see it.
Yeah.
It cannot be easy, that's all I can tell you, for a novelist to see their work no matter what, unless you took every scene, every line, every element of the book and put it on the screen, which would be perhaps in a miniseries or a long series, it can't be what she wrote.
Yeah.
And unless you're in a very surrendered state, you're going to suffer.
And can you talk a little about some of the challenges you're facing in adapting Ghost for the stage?
I don't want to talk too much about that, but it's completely thrilling to be working on a musical. That's all I can tell you. I love every moment of it, and I love being a writer in a medium where they have to ask you, "Can I change this line?"
Are you writing the lyrics or just the book?
I wrote 20 songs. Okay. About 3 remain at this point. Dave Stewart and Glenn Ballard were doing the music, and they're doing a lot of the lyrics now. Yeah. The director said to me, "Dave is a really good songwriter, Bruce. Why don't you let him do this?" And I just said, "Okay."
I didn't know that about Jennifer Aniston and Brad.
Oh, I don't. It's their company that's doing this movie, it was their company.
So up until what point were they going to be starring in it?
Oh no, never, never. Don't even print that they were starring in it. They were just. It was their company.
Oh, you were writing it for them, as in you were writing it.
I never got that far. I just, in my mind, if I was writing this movie, if I had gotten the job, they were the two people that I was hoping, based on the fact that they had made this deal to make this movie. I thought they would be perfect for the film.
Why?
Why? Because I saw them as Henry and Claire. I just did. They just seemed like a perfect version of Henry and Claire.
And what was it about them and about the characters that
fit? I just found them equally attractive, equally compelling. You know, in terms of the Hollywood sort of arena at that moment in time, they were as good a couple as you could find, and I thought I would love to see them together in a movie.
So could you say that the relationship in the screenplay is written so it's meant about that?
No. By the time I wrote it, they were no longer.
That's quite obvious. Okay. Even the kind of idea.
I think I really moved beyond that. Don't do headlines saying Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston were supposed to star in this movie.
Right,
that was never ever the case. But it is was their company and is now still his company,
right,
that is making this movie or has made this movie.
Bruce, was there any similarity for you in the adaptation between the adaptations of this and Last Mimsy, that process?
Well, no. This Les Mimsy had a short story as a basis that we just took the idea from. This had a full-blown, wonderful, realized sort of series of characters and plot, and it had everything. I had to eliminate from the book, and in the Les Mimsy, I had to create a story. The Les Mimsy movie is really it's not really anybody's movie. I mean, it's really a movie that I wrote pretty much from imagination, whereas this movie was trying to, in many ways, represent as best as possible Audrey's vision.
You mentioned some of the frustrations of being a writer, where when you write something, it's not always exactly what you thought on the screen. Now, have you ever thought of, like, directing? Because a lot of the writers I've spoken to who eventually get directing...
I have. I did direct one film called My Life many years ago with Nicole Kidman and Michael Keaton.
And do you feel that that's something which...
I found that I was able to destroy my work as well as anybody else. It turned out to be an okay movie, but I realized I was a mediocre director. That was a big deal for me. I hadn't, you know, you don't know until you do it. I mean, I think if I directed 20 movies, I'd actually be a good director. But because I started all of this late, I'm not going to get a chance to do 40 movies. But the one thing I've been doing a lot of is writing, so I figured stick with what you know.
Thanks, everyone.
Where do you keep your Oscar?
Right next to my bed, actually. It's where I put it when I came home, and it has never moved.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Sorry, I'm passing the movie I just did.